For many years, the Wasp Empire has been expanding, warring on its neighbors and enslaving them. Having concluded its 12-year war against the Dragonfly Commonweal, the Wasps have now turned their eyes toward the divided lowlands. Stenwold Maker realized the truth of the Empire's power when it seized the distant city of Mina. Since then, he has been sending out covert agents to track the progress of an enemy whose threat his fellow citizens will not recognize. Among these agents are his niece Cheerwell, his ward Tanisa, the exotic dragonfly Prince Salma, a humble half-breed artificer Totho, and staunchest of his allies is the terrifying Mattis warrior Tissimon. But can their efforts bring the lowlands to their senses before it is all too late? 1. The morning was joyless for him, as mornings always were. He arose from silks and bee fur, and felt on his skin the insidious cold that these rooms only shook off for a scant month or two in the heart of summer. He wondered whether he could be accommodated somewhere else, as he had wondered countless times before, and knew that it would not do. It would be, in some unspecified way, disloyal. He was a prisoner of his own public image. Besides, these rooms had some advantages. No windows, for one. The sun came in through shafts set into the ceiling, 3 dozen of them, and each too small for even the most limber fly-kindan assassin to sneak through. He had been told that the effect of this fragmented light was beautiful, although he saw beauty in few things, and none at all in architecture. His people had been building these ziggurats, as symbols of their leader's power since forever, but the style of building that had reached its apex here in the great palace at Capitus had overreached itself. The northern hill tribes, left behind by the sword of progress, still had their stepped pyramids atop the mounds of their hill forts. The design had changed little, only the scale, so that he who ought to expect all things as he wanted was entombed in a grotesque overgrown edifice which never truly warmed at its core. He slung on a gown, trimmed with the fur of 300 moths. There were guards stationed outside his door, he knew, and they were for his own protection, but he felt sometimes that they were really his jailers, and that the servants now entering were merely here to torment him. He could have them killed at a word, of course, and he needed to give no reason for it. But he had tried to amuse himself in such capricious ways before, and found no real joy in it. What was the point in having the wretches killed, when there were always yet more, an inexhaustible legion of them, world without end? What a depressing prospect! That a man could wade neck-deep in the blood of his servants, and there would still be men and women ready to enter his service more numerous than the motes of dust dancing in the shafts of sunlight from above. His father had taken no joy in the rank and power that was his. His father had run through life, never taking time to stop, to look, to think. He had been born with a sword in his hand, if you believe the stories, and with destiny like an invisible crown about his brow. The man in the fur-lined gown knew what that felt like. It felt like a vice around the forehead, forbidding him rest or peace. His father had died 8 years ago. No assassin's blade, no poison, no battle wound or lancing arrow. He had just fallen ill all of a sudden. And 10 days later he just stopped, like a clock, and neither doctor nor artificer could wind him up again. His father had died, and in the 10 days before, and the 10 days after, all of his father's children bar 2, all of this man's siblings bar 1, had died also. They had died by public execution, or covert murder, for good reason, or for no reason other than that the succession, his succession, must be undisputed. He was the eldest son, But he knew that the right of primogeniture ran thin where lordly ambitions were concerned. He had spared one sister only, the youngest. She had been 8 years old then, and something had failed in him when they presented him with the death warrant to sign. She was 16 now, and she looked at him always with the carefully bland adoration of a subject. But he feared the thoughts that swam behind that gaze, feared them enough to wake sweat-sodden when even dreaming of them. And the order lay before him still, to have her removed, the one other remaining member of his bloodline. As soon as he had a true-blood son of his own, it would be done. He would take no pleasure in it, no more than he would take in the fathering. He understood his own father's life now, whose shadow he raced to outreach. Yet how envied he was! How his generals and courtiers and advisers cursed their luck that he should sit where he did and not they! Yet they could not know that from the seat of a throne the whole weighty ziggurat of state was turned on its point, and the entire hegemony's weight from the broad base of the numberless slaves, through the subject peoples and all the ranks of the army to the generals, was balanced solely upon him. He represented their hope and their inspiration, and their expectations were loaded upon him. The servants who washed and dressed him were all of the true race. At the heart of a culture built on slavery, there were few outlander slaves permitted in the palace, for who among them could be trusted? Besides, even the most menial tasks were counted an honor when performed for him. Of foreign slaves, there were only a handful of advisers, sages, artificers, and others whose skills recommended them beyond the lowly stain of their blood. And though they were slaves, they lived like princes while they were still of use to him. His advisers, yes. He was to speak with his advisers later. Before that, there were matters of state to attend to. Always the chains of office dragged him down. Robed now as befitted his station, his brow bound with gold and ebony, His Imperial Majesty Alvdan II, Lord of the Wasp Empire, prepared to reascend his throne. The Emperor kept many advisers, and every 10 days he met with them all, a chance for them to speak on whatever subject they felt would best serve himself and his empire. It was his father's custom, too, a part of that clamorous, ever-running life of his that had taken him early to his grave as the empire's greatest slave and not its master. This generation's Alvdan would gladly have done without it, but it was as much a part of the emperor as were the throne and the crown, and he could not cut it from him. The individual advisers were another matter. Each 10 days the faces might be different, some removed by his own orders, others by his loyal men of the Rekhef. Some of his advisers were Rekhef themselves, but he was pleased to note that this was no shield against either his displeasure or that of his subordinates. Some of the advisers were slaves, another long tradition, for the empire always made the best use of its resources. Scholarly men from conquered cities were often dragged to Capitus simply for the contents of their minds. Some prospered, as much as any slave could in this empire, and better than many free men did. Others failed and fell. There were always more. His council, thus gathered, would be the usual tedious mix. There would be one or two woodlouse kindin with their long and mournful gray faces, professing wisdom and counseling caution. There would be several beadles, merchants or artificers. Perhaps some oddity, like a spider kindin from the far south, a blank-eyed moth or similar. And the locals, of course, wasp kindin from the Rekhef, from the army, diplomats, consortium factors, members of high-placed families, and even maverick adventurers. And they would all have counsel to offer, and it would serve them more often than not if he followed it. His progress into the room was measured in servants who opened the doors for him, swept the floor before his feet, removed his outer robe and the weight of the crown. Others were serving him wine and sweetmeats even as he sat down, food and drink foretasted by yet more invisible underlings. His advisers sat on either side of him, in a shallow crescent of lower seats. The idea was that the emperor should look straight ahead, and only hear the words of wisdom that tinkled in his ears, without being in any way swayed by the identity of the speaker. Ideologically brilliant, of course, though practically useless, since he had an ear keen enough to identify any of the speakers from a single uttered word. Instead, all they gained for themselves were stiff necks as everyone craned around to look at whoever spoke. I could change this. He was, after all, the emperor. He could have them sitting around a table, like off-duty soldiers on a gambling spree, or kneeling before him like supplicants, or hanging on wires from the ceiling if he so wanted. Not a day went by without some petty detail of the imperial bureaucracy throwing thorns beneath his feet. Yet he always found a reason not to thrust his hand into the works of the machine. It would be bad for morale. It had worked thus far. It was for a good reason. Or why would they do it like that? And in his worst dreams, he heard the true reason for his own reticence. For at each change he implemented, each branch he hacked from the tradition tree, they would all doubtless murmur, "He's not the man his father was." He had sired a legion of short-lived bastards, and no true-blood sons. And perhaps that was why. The burden of the imperial inheritance that he did not want to pass to any child of his. Still, that problematic situation was looming closer each year. The imperial succession was a matter he had forbidden his advisers to speak on. But he felt the weight of it on him nonetheless. The assembled advisers shuffled in their seats, waiting for his gesture to begin, and he gave it, listening without interest as the first few inconsequential-seeming matters were brought before him. A famine in the East Empire, so perhaps some artificers should be sent to teach the ignorant savages something approaching modern agriculture. A lazy gesture signaled his assent. A proposal for games to celebrate the first victory over the lowlands, whenever it happened. He ruled against that, judging it too soon. Another proposal, this from the sad-faced woodlouse Kindan Jagethi, who had a sufficient balance of wisdom and acumen to have served Alfdan's father for the last 9 years of his reign, and yet survived the purges that had accompanied the coronation. "It might be possible to proceed more gently in our invasion plans," the soft-voiced old man said. He was a freakish specimen, as all his people were. A whole head taller than any reasonable man, and with his gray skin marked by pale bands up over his brow and down his back. His eyes were lost in a nest of wrinkles. "These lowlanders have much knowledge of mechanics, philosophy, logistics, that we might benefit from. Gentle hand." Alfdan sat back and let the debate run, hearing the military argue about the risk inherent in relying on a slow conquest, while the Rekef insisted that foreigners could not be trusted, and the consortium pressed for a swift assault that would see their lowland trading rivals crushed. All self-interest, of course, but not necessarily bad for the empire. He held up a hand, and they fell silent. "We have faith in our generals," was all he said. And that was that. Before speaking, the next speaker paused long enough that Alfdan had a chance to steel himself for the words to come. "Your Imperial Majesty." General Maxson, whose frown could set the entire Rekhef trembling, began carefully. "There remains the matter of your sister." "Does there?" Alfdan stared straight ahead, with a tight-lipped smile that he knew must chill them all. "There are those who would..." "We know, General. Our dear sister has a faction, a party, but she has it whether she wishes it or not. They would put her on this seat of mine because they think she would love them for it. So she must be put to death, like all the others. Are you going to counsel us now about the place of mercy in Imperial doctrine, or lack of it?" He heard nothing, but in the corner of his eye caught a motion that was Maxson shaking his head. "Do you remember General Scarrad?" The Emperor continued. "I believe he was the last man to counsel us about mercy. An unwise trait in a ruler of men, he claimed." "Yes, Your Imperial Majesty." "Remind us of our response, General." "You agreed with him, praised him for his philosophy, and then had him put to death, Your Majesty," replied General Maxson levelly. "We praise you for your memory, General, so pray continue." "An alternative disposition of your sister has been suggested to me, Your Imperial Majesty," Maxson said, picking his way carefully. "She cannot be married, obviously, and she is not fit for office. So perhaps she should find some peace of mind in some secular body. Some philosophical order, Majesty, with no political aspirations." Alfdan closed his eyes, trying to picture his sister in the robes of the Mercy's daughters, or some such pack of hags. "Your suggestion is noted, General, and we will consider it," was all he would say. But it appealed to his sense of humor. "Yes, a nice peaceful life of contemplation. How better to drive his little sister out of her mind?" When he was done, and his advisers had no more advice to give, the servants repeated their rigmarole, but this time in reverse. Once he had stood up, his advisers began to sidle out of the room, leaving only General Maxson, who seemed to be taking an unaccountably long time to adjust his sword belt. "General, we sense by your subtlety that you wish to speak to us. Some small diversion, Your Imperial Majesty, if you wish it." "The Rekhef are becoming entertainers now, are they, General?" "There is a man, Majesty, who has fallen into the hands of my agents. He is a most remarkable and unusual man, and I thought that Your Majesty might welcome the chance to meet this individual. He is a slave, of course, and worse than just a slave, not fit to serve any useful purpose. In private, he is full of strange words, though. Your Imperial Majesty's education might never have another chance such as this." Alfdan at last looked at Maxson directly, seeing a slight smile on the stocky old soldier's face. Maxson had not advised his father, the late Emperor, but he had been wielding a knife on the night after Alfdan's coronation, making sure that the next morning would be free from sibling dissent or disunity. He was not one for jokes. "Well, General, we are intrigued. Take us to this man." The flight had been like something out of a fever dream, nightmarish and unheard of. Thalric had come to Asta expecting to be punished. He had anticipated encountering the grim face of Colonel Latvok, or even the pinched features of General Reiner, his superiors within the Rekhef, because he had failed the Empire. There had been a mission to seize the rail automotive that the city of Helleron had called the Pride, which was then to have provided the spearhead of an invasion to sack Collegium and have any dreams of Lowland's unity die stillborn. Instead, motley renegades, under the command of Stenwold Maker, had destroyed the Pride and even managed somehow to cast suspicion of that destruction on the Waspkinden who had so stalwartly tried to save it. A small setback for the Empire, which must take by force now what might have been won by stealth. A great setback indeed for Captain Thalric of the Imperial Army, otherwise Major Thalric of the Rekkath Outlander. And yet there had been no court-martial for him to face in the staging town of Asta. It seemed that the race for the Lowlands was now on, and even a flawed blade like Thalric could be put to good use. There had been sealed orders already awaiting him. Board the Cloudfarer. Further instructions to follow. And the Cloudfarer itself. It was a piece of madness, and no Wasp artificer had made her. Some maverick auxilian technologist had come up with that design and inflicted it upon him. It had no hull, or at least very little of one. Instead, there was a reinforced wooden base and a scaffold of struts that composed a kind of empty cage. There was a clockwork engine aft, which two men wound by pedaling furiously, and somewhat stubby wings that bore twin propellers. Thalric had boarded, along with a pilot engineer and Lieutenant Tabaro, Flykinden agent of the Rekkath, who was to brief him. Then the Cloudfarer had lifted off, a fragile lattice of wood shuddering up and up through the air under the impelling force of her propellers. Up and up, rising in as tight a spiral as her pilot could drag her into, until they were sailing across the clouds indeed, and higher. Then the pilot let go the struts to either side, and the Cloudfarer's vast gray wings fell open left and right, above and below, and caught the wind. The vessel that had seemed some apprentice's mistake was abruptly speeding over the world beneath it, soaring on swift winds westward, until they were casting across the lowlands as high, it almost seemed, as the stars themselves sailed. And it was so cold. Thalric was muffled in four cloaks and layers of woolens beneath. Yet the chill air cut through it all. An invisible blade that lanced through the open structure of the Cloudfarer and put a rime of white frost on him, and painted his breath into white plumes before the wind whipped it away. They would reach Collegium faster than any messenger, eating up any lead that Stenwold had built, so that despite Thalric's detour to Asta, it was anyone's guess who would arrive first. They were so high, up in the very icy roof of the sky, that no flying scout would spy them. Even telescopes might not pick out their silvery wings against the distant vault of the heavens. And as he suffered through this ordeal, from the cold and the wind, he hunched forward to catch Tabaro's fleeting words. For these were his instructions, his mission, and he would need to remember them. "You're a lucky man," the fly said, shouting over the gale. "Rekkath can't spare an operative of your experience, simply for a disciplinary trial. Lowland's work to be done all over the place. You get a second chance. Don't waste it." They had worked together before, Thalric and Tabaro, and a measure of respect had grown between them. "We'll put you down near Collegium," Tabaro continued. "Make your own way in. Meet with your agents there. There can be no unity allowed for the Lowlands. There are two plans. The first is swifter than the second, but you are to enact both of them if possible. Even if the first succeeds, the second will also help the war effort." And Tabaro had explained to him then just what those plans were. And whilst the first was a commonplace enough piece of work, the second was a sharp one, and the scale of it shook him a little. It shall be done, he assured the fly, as the cloudfarer continued its swift, invisible passage over the lowlands so far beneath them. He walked into Collegium without mishap, entering at the slow time near noon, when the city seemed to sleep a little. Collegium had white walls, but the gates had stood open for 20 years, had only been closed even then because the ants of Vec had harbored ambitions to annex the Beetle City for themselves. There was a guard sitting by the gate, an old Beetle Kindan who was dozing a little himself. Collegium was not interested in keeping people out. If it had been, then he might not have needed to destroy it. Thalric had been granted a short enough time in the city when he was here last, 2 days only, and then he had been bundled onto a fixed-wing flyer to go and catch Stenwold Maker on the airship sky without. At that thought, he tried to discern where the airfield lay from here, and see whether the great dirigible was moored there today. But the walls were too high, the buildings looming above him, for much of Collegium was 3-story, and the poorer districts were 4 or 5. He knew that the Empire had much to learn here. The poor of Collegium cursed their lot, and complained and envied, but they had never witnessed how the poor of Helleron lived, or the Imperial poor, or the slaves of countless other cities. If we destroy Collegium, will we ever regain what is lost in the fires? Because it was not only a matter of writing down some secret taken from one of the countless books in the college library. This was a way of life, and it was a good thing to have. And like all good things, the Empire should have it. Imperial citizens should benefit from the knowledge of the men and women who had built this place. But the second plan that Tabaro had given him would kill all that. And he had his orders. The kernel of discontent that had been within him for a while now gave him a familiar kick. But he mastered it. If the Empire wanted things in such a way, the Empire would have it. He was loyal to the Empire. He stopped so suddenly in the street that a pair of men manhandling a trunk barged into him and swore at him before they passed on. What a heretical idea! Better keep that one hidden deep in one's own thoughts. To even think that loyalty to the Empire, to the better future of the Empire, was not the same as loyalty to the Emperor's edicts or to the Rekef's plans. Well, that sort of thinking would get a man on the interrogation table in a hurry. He had avoided a well-deserved reprimand for failing at Helleron, and he wasn't about to start playing host to that kind of thought now. That was just asking for trouble. But in the deepest recesses of his mind, the idea turned over and waited for another off-guard moment. There had been Rekef agents before him in Collegium, of course. Whilst the Inlander branch of the Empire's Secret Service purged the disloyal at home, the Outlander had been seeding the cities of the lowlands with spies and informants. Thalric had made contact with them when he was here last, but their networks were 4 years old. Thalric sent fly messengers across the city with innocuous letters into which code words had been dropped like poison into wine. Those men and women the Rekef had infiltrated into this city had been making everyday lives for themselves. Now that was to end. He was calling them up. He met with them in a low sailor's taverna, near enough to the docks for them to hear the creak of rigging through the windows. It was a place where people would forget who it was that met with who, or what business might have been done there. And that was just as well, too. They made an ill-assorted quartet. The most senior was a lieutenant in the Rekef, and when Thalric had needed a pair of assassins to catch Stenwold Maker in his home, he had gone to Lieutenant Graff True Blood Waspkinden, who was working here as a procurer for the blades trade. That, in local parlance, meant that he made introductions between fighting men and prospective patrons. And it put Thalric's operation here on a sound footing straight off. Graf was a lean man, his face marred by a ragged sword scar from brow to chin, that Thalric knew for a dueling mark from the man's days in the Arms Brethren. The eye traversed by that scar was a dark marble of glass. The other three were all unranked on the Rekhef books, mere agents. Hofi was a Flykinden who cut the hair of the rich and shaved the mighty, and Arianna was a spider and a student of the college. The fourth man, Skadran, the half-breed, worked as a dockhand, catching all the rumors going in and out from both ways down the coast. Wasp blood adulterated with beetle and ant, his heavy features displayed the worst of all three to Thalric's eyes. But he was a big man, a brawler. That might be useful in the end. He had them at a corner table, drawn far enough from the others that low voices would not carry. They had come in plain garb and armed, and they looked at him expectantly. If he sent them out into the city to kill that very night, they would be ready. "Tell me about Stenwold Maker," he said. Lieutenant Graf glanced at the others and then spoke. "He arrived the day before you, sir. Quite a tale of followers, too. Was there a Mattiskinden with them?" Thalric asked. His mind returned abruptly to the night battle at the engine works at Halloran that had seen the Pride destroyed. There had been a Mattis there, making bloody work of every man who came against him, until Thalric had burned him. Tissamon, Scylla's reports had named him, and his daughter had been Tanisa. Tanisa, who had very nearly done for Thalric when he came to finish the matter. In his heart he had hoped that the man had died from his wound. But Graf's next words surprised him not at all. "Yes, sir. His name is Tissamon. I've learned he was a student at the college many years ago, at the same time as Maker. Even from back then he had a reputation." "And well-deserved," Thalric confirmed. "What movements?" "Maker settling his men in. He's applied to speak before the assembly, but that's likely to take a few days. He's not exactly popular. A maverick, they think, and he leaves his college duties too often. They'll stall him with bureaucracy for a while, maybe even a 10-day before they let him in. A slap on the wrist." "And the rest?" "Many of the others are now at the college," Arianna said. "Some are in the infirmary, in fact. They brought some wounded with them from Halloran. There's a monstrous little wretch with them, though. Some spiky Kinden I've never seen before, and he's been going about the factories a lot, the engine yards and the rail depot." "That would be Skuto," Thalric explained. "Stenwold's deputy from Halloran. He's an artificer, I understand, so some of that might just be professional curiosity." Thalric remembered his one meeting with Stenwold Maker, a few brave words over a shared drink. Two men in the same work on opposite sides, but common ground nonetheless. They were two soldiers who had suffered the same privations under different flags. "And now I stalk him to his lair, and I must destroy him. Because I must believe he would do the same to me, I shall feel nothing." "I have your orders," he addressed the foursome. "We'll need armed men, Lieutenant, and craft from the rest of you. Stenwold Maker is not long for this world." 2. To live in an Antkinden city was to understand silence, and he had spent time in a few. There was the silence of everyday tasks, which meant that one heard only the slaves cluttering about, whispering to one another. There was the silence of the drilling field, where there were marching feet and the clink of armor, but never a raised voice or a shouted command. 500 soldiers, perhaps, in perfect formation and perfect order. There was the silence after dark, when families sat together with closed lips, while the slaves stayed huddled in their garrets or outbuildings. Then there was this silence, this new silence. It was the silence of a city full of people who knew that the enemy, in its thousands, was camped before their gate. Nero hurried through this silence bundled in his cloak. All around him, the city of Tark was pacing along at its usual speed. At the sparse little stalls, local merchants handed over goods wordlessly, receiving exactly the correct money in return. Children ran in the street or played martial games, and only the youngest, 8 years old or less, ever laughed or called out. Men and women stood in small groups on street corners and said nothing. There was an edge to them all, and in that unimaginable field extending between their minds, there was a single topic of unheard conversation. It was once different, of course, in the foreigner's quarter where he was lodging. 10 days ago it had been a riotous bloom of color, penned in by the ant militia, but shaped by countless hands into 100 little homes away from home. Now there was a hush over that quarter as well, because all but the most stubbornly entrenched residents had fled. And I should have gone with them. He had been in Tark a year, not long enough to put down roots, but at the same time perhaps the longest he had spent anywhere since collegium. What keeps me here? Guilt, he decided. Guilt because he knew this day would come, when the gold and black hoard would pour into the lowlands, and he had done nothing. He had walked away once the knives were out, and not looked back. He attracted little notice from the locals, for he was well known in this part of the city, which meant in any part, given that the local opinion of him could be passed mind to mind as easily as passing a bottle in a taverna. They looked down on him because he was a foreigner, and a fly-kindon, and an itinerant artist. On the other hand, he had friends here, and he stayed out of trouble, and therefore he was tolerated. Not that staying out of trouble was an infallible recipe. 3 10 days before, a house had been robbed beyond the foreigner's quarter. The militia, unable to track down the culprit, had simply hanged 3 foreigners at random. Visitors, they were saying, were there only on sufferance and were expected to police themselves. He was an ugly little man, quite bald and with a knuckly face, a heavy brow and broken nose combined with a pugnacious chin to make a profile as lumpy as a clenched fist. Flykinden were seldom the most pleasant race to look at, and his appearance was distinctly nasty. If he had been of any other kin, he would have hulked and intimidated his way through life, but no amount of belligerent features could salvage him from being only 4 feet from his sandals to the top of his hairless head. His name was Nero, and he had made a living for the last 20 years as an artist of such caliber that his name and his work could open select doors all across the lowlands. In his own mind, that was just a sideline. In a land where most people never saw much beyond their own city's walls, unless for commercial purposes, he was a seasoned traveler. He rolled from city to city by whatever road his feet preferred, imposed on the hospitality of whoever would take him in, and did whatever he wanted. Which brought him back to the present, because he now wanted, if his continuing presence was anything to go by, to be involved in a siege and bloody war. He himself was unclear on this point, but so far he had not felt inclined to leave, and shortly he suspected that he would not be able to do so without being shot out of the sky by the Wasp-Blight airborne. Ahead of him, the city wall of Tark was a grand, pale jigsaw puzzle of great stones, adorned with its murder holes, its crenellations, passages, and engines of destruction. In its shadow, the Ant-Kindon were calm. This wall had withstood sieges before, when their own kin of other cities had come to fight against them, just as Tarkesh armies had been repulsed by the walls of those kinfolk in Kes or Sarn. Nero knew that the army now outside was not composed of Ant-Kindon, and would not fight like them. Whenever he had that thought, he had a terrible itching to be gone, and yet here he still was. Perops was of unusual character for an ant, especially an officer. His friendship with Nero had begun on rocky ground, when the Universal Grapevine had informed him that the woman picked out as his mate was sitting nude before the fly's easel, and he was a joke across the city before he had stormed across to Ramon Street. Ant paintings were a strange business, though, made for the convenience of the city and the furtherance of children, and they lacked the personal investment, the jealousies and passions of other kindred. In truth, after their coupling was achieved, the two of them had grown bored of one another. Nero had been one of a line of diversions she had taken up. And of course Perops had been expected to kill the fly on the spot, both by his mate and the city at large. Not from rage, for ants were rarely given to it, but for the affront to his racial, civic, and personal dignity. Instead, he had passed most of the night up on the roof by Nero's side, looking out over the city and talking about other places. Perops was a wild eccentric by ant standards, which meant that he entertained unusual thoughts occasionally. His natural intelligence had brought him just so far up the ladder of rank, and he knew that he would never receive further promotion. In the opinion of his superiors, he was not wholly sound. So here he was, a tower commander on the walls of Tark, a position considered more bureaucratic than military until now. Now he stood at the arrow-slit window of his study and looked down over the checkerboard of the Wasp army. The late sunlight played on his bleached skin. "How are the negotiations going?" Nero inquired, for a Wasp embassy had been admitted to the city earlier that day. While Perops was not privy to their debate, news of its progress loomed large in the collective mind of the city, silently passed from neighbor to neighbor in rippling waves of information.
"Still keeping them waiting," the ant explained.
"It's their prerogative," Nero allowed. "So what are they doing meanwhile?"
"There are some spider-kindon slavers left in the city," Perops said, "and some of them have scorpion-kindon on their staff. It seems that the scorpions and the wasps go way back, mostly in the same trade, so we have people paying the scorpions for their recollections. The royal court is busy putting the picture together."
"How seriously are they taking it?"
"There are 30,000 soldiers at our gates," Perops pointed out.
"Yes, but you know how politics goes. Everyone's city is the greatest, and everyone's soldiers are invincible, at least until they get vinced."
Perops nodded. "They're taking it seriously, plentifully seriously. They've gone to the tunnels and spoken to the Nest Queen herself, woken up the flying brood. They're putting in readiness every machine that can take to the air. Everyone who can pilot a flyer or handle artillery is getting marching orders, and it's crossbows for everyone else. It's a flying enemy we face, and that much we understand. It's something new."
And ants did not like new things, Nero reflected. but at least the complacency had gone. The ant nest beneath the city, which produced domesticated insects that labored for their human namesakes, was a valuable resource. To utilize the winged males and females as mounts of war would kill off an entire generation of them, a tragedy of economics which meant they were only brought out in the worst of emergencies. The Royal Court of Tarkat finally conceded that this was nothing less.
"You've had some dealings with these wasps," Perops noted. "As few as I could, but yes, a long time ago. Tell me about the other kingdom they have in their army. Have they formed an alliance against us?"
"The Wasp Empire doesn't do alliances," Nero said with a harsh laugh. "Those are slaves."
"They arm their slaves?"
The ants of Tark, as with Antkindon almost everywhere, kept slaves for the menial work, and would not dream of putting so much as a large knife in their hands. It was not so much for fear of rebellion as pride in their own martial skills.
"It's more complicated than that. They deal in very large armies, and they swell their ranks with the conquered. Auxilians, they call them. They enslave whole cities, you see. Then they ship out fighters to some part of their empire remote from their homes and set them to it. It's as though here you got sent out to Collegium or Vec or somewhere. I imagine sometimes it doesn't work, but mostly the men sent out there will have family back home, and they'll know that if they run or turn on their masters, that their kin will suffer. And so they fight. They'll either be skilled help, artificers and the like, or just bow fodder, first into the breach. It can't be much of a prospect."
Perops nodded again. And Nero felt a shiver as he realized that his words would be at large in the city now, darting from mind to mind, perhaps even reaching the royal court itself.
"There are still some foreigners leaving by the west gate," the ant said carefully. "In fact, there are still foreigners coming in by the west gate, mostly slavers hunting a late sale. It's probably time you made your move."
"I'll stay a little while," Nero said casually.
"I get the impression that when these fellows draw a sword, they're not going to care what kindred you are if you're found inside the walls."
"More than likely true," Nero admitted.
Perops at last turned from the window, and his obsessive scrutiny of the near future.
"Why are you here, Nero?" he asked. "Your race is hardly renowned for its staying power in the fray. You run further to live longer. Isn't that it? So why haven't you done what any sensible human being would do and run while you can?"
Nero shrugged. Partly it was due to his friendship with Perops, of course. But there was another reason, and it was such a personal, trivial thing that he was ashamed to admit it.
"I've never witnessed a war," he said. "I've put a few skirmishes under my belt over the years, but never a war. Not really. I did a study once, the Battle of the Gears at the Collegium Gates, you know, and shall we say critical reception was lukewarm? That's because it was beyond my experience, and I couldn't capture it. And so that's my reason. As good as any other. And it's a poor one, I know."
"You are quite mad," Perops told him.
"Probably. However, my own kindred are very good at squeaking out at the last minute, and there are still a few grains of sands in the glass. You never know. Perhaps I'll reclaim my heritage after all."
"Don't leave it too long," Perops warned.
And then some fresh word came to him, invisible through the crowded air of the city.
"They have taken the ambassadors in, at last," he announced.
When Skrill came running back, she was ducking low amidst the sprays of man-high sword grass. Her progress involved a series of sudden dashes across less covered ground, moving with her long legs at a speed Salma knew he himself could not have matched. Then she would freeze into immobility, hunched under cover, an arrow already fitted to her bowstring. He and Totho were dug in together, beneath one of the great knots of grass that arched over them with its narrow, sharp-edged fronds. They watched Skrill's punctuated progress impatiently. Then she had flung herself to a halt beside them, bowling into them in a flurry of loose earth. She was a strange creature, half-breed of mine and soldier beetle and something else, and with no manners or education to recommend her. But she had led them flawlessly to within sight of the Wasp army, as if she knew every inch of the terrain. "What did you see?" Totho asked her. "Did you see her, or the daughters?" Salma interrupted. She gave him a wide-eyed, mocking look. "Did you perchance not notice those many thousand soldiers out there, your lordship? Wherever your glittery lady is, she ain't parading herself about their camp now, is she? So no, I didn't happen to meet her and invite her over here for a pint and a chat." She shook her head, one hand coming up to tug at her pointed ears as though trying to make them longer. "I didn't even get close to the camp because they got 1,000 men on sentry duty, or that's like it looked to me. A whole ring of them, and earthworks, palisade, even little looky-outy towers. And the sky. Don't even get me started. If you was thinking about just swanning in with those wings of yours, you best put that candle right out. They got men circling and circling like flies on a 10-day dead corpse. They plainly reckon the ants'll give 'em grief. And why not? I would if I was running things at Tarkhall." "Ants are too straight for that, aren't they?" Totho asked. "I thought they'd just line up and fight."
"Don't believe it, beetle boy," she told him. "Ants'll play the dirty trick same as anyone. They do war beatly, and war means day and night work. Nobody ever won a war just by fighting fair."
"Don't call me that," Totho said, for the nicknames she used were starting to gall him. "I'm no more a beetle than you are a whatever it is you are, or aren't."
"Am I a beetle?"
"No."
"Is his lordship a beetle?"
"No."
"Then you get to be beetle boy unless we can get a better beetle than you," she told him without sympathy.
"Will the pair of you be—"
Salma had started to hiss. And then the wasps were in sight, skimming at just a man's height and touching the tops of the sword grass as they came. In that same moment they had clearly spotted the three spies. There were half a dozen of them, light airborne, out merely on a scouting mission. But wasps were a pugnacious lot, and never ones to shirk a fight. Their leader shouted an order, and two of them broke off, arrowing back toward their camp. The others sped toward Salma with swords drawn and palms outstretched to unleash their energy stings. Skrill shot one straight off, leaping up with her sudden speed and loosing an arrow that split the second oncomer's eye. The wasp flyer recoiled in the air and then dropped from sight amidst the tall grass. Salma had no time to string his own bow. As the three remaining soldiers launched the golden lightning of their stings, he let his wings take him straight upward, his short sword, stolen wasp make itself, clearing its scabbard. Skrill had already dashed to one side, but Totho had no option but to cast himself to the ground and hope. He felt one sting lash across his pack, as though he had been punched there by a strong man. Then he was up with a magazine slotted into his crossbow. One of the men had skimmed upward in pursuit of Salma, and it struck Totho how they seemed nimbler in the air than most wasps, obviously hand-picked as scouts. He raised his bow and loosed. The man coming for him jinked aside, and the bolt sped past him. Totho saw the man's face split into a grin, in the knowledge that there would be no reloading of such a cumbersome weapon as a crossbow in time. By then, Totho was racking back the lever and shooting again and again, seeing surprise and dismay splash across those same features. The man dodged the second shot, but not the third, nor the fourth or fifth, and he plowed dead into the earth 6 feet away. They were a race of builders and artificers, the wasps,
But for all their numbers and ingenuity, they were behind the lowlands yet in craft. He heard a shout nearby and saw Skrill fighting furiously with another enemy, sword to sword. She was swift, her blade lunging and darting like a living thing. But her opponent was a professional, and the metal plates of his armor kept turning aside her blows. Tofu knew he couldn't risk a shot in their direction, and drew his own blade, breaking cover to run to her aid. Above them, Salma dived and spun in a deadly aerial ballet with his opponent. For them, distance was all. Too close and they would foul each other. Too far and the wasp would have more chance to use his sting. Amidst their aerobatics, their swords flashed rarely, each seeking a second's opening to strike against side or back. Salma was Dragonfly Kindan, born to the air, and his race prided themselves on their grace and control while on the wing. The wasp, for his part, was as fleet and nimble as his kind ever were. But there was a distance even so. Salma had abruptly cut away, seeming to falter in the air, allowing the wasp to draw up to shoot at him. In that same moment, Salma reversed his motion, wings powering him forward. The man tried to angle down to face him head-on, sword sweeping in a broad parry, but Salma was through his guard on the instant, driving the blade between the wasp's ribs where his armor left off, and then using the pull of the man's heavy descent to drag the steel from his corpse. He touched down, looking around for more enemies just in time to see Totho and Skrill finish off the last wasp scout together. "Get your kit together," Skrill urged him. "There'll be more." Salma scooped up his satchel, seeing Tofo shoulder the big canvas bag that held his tools and belongings. "I travel very light these days," the dragonfly thought wryly. "But of course, being captured and stripped of your possessions would do that to a man." He had only what the mine and resistance had been able to find for him. Skrill's kit bag was already strapped on her back, a position it never left, save when she was using it as a lumpy pillow. She pelted past him, even as he and Totho were collecting their gear, and they ran after her, knowing it was vain to try to catch up. The wasp armies had yet to invest the city of Turk in siege. "But for us, the war has already started." He remembered his talk with Agon, the wasp artificer, whose information had originally sent him south to Turk, the same who had been given the butterfly dancer named Grief in Chains, and then released her with the name Agon's Joy. Salma had now killed another wasp, his first since then. There had been no hesitation at the time. After all, the man had been trying to kill him. And yes, the wasp had been another human being with all a man's hopes and aspirations, and now snuffed out by 18 inches of steel. But also there had been enough dragonfly dead during the 12-year war to make the numbers now massed outside Turk pale into insignificance. Amongst them, his own father and three cousins, including his favorite, Felipe Dalles. Not just Kindan, but kin. Blood that called out for a leveling of the scales. Three principalities of the dragonfly commonweal that groaned under the boot of the empire. He hardened his heart. There would be more blood spilled before the end of this, and some of it could easily be his own. Skrill had stopped ahead, waiting for them. Totho blundered up to her. "And how did they find us?" he demanded. "Scouts, Beetle Boy. What do you think they were doing?" "They followed you." "You take them words back, or we're looking to have a disagreement right here," she said hotly. "Nobody asked you to link with us." Totho swallowed whatever words he had been going to utter, and after a moment's thought said, "Well, it's just as well I did, or you'd have been spitted right back there. What do you think of that?" "Will the pair of you be quiet?" Salma grumbled without much hope. "I was playing with him," Skrill said. "I was..." Suddenly she fell silent, turning away from Tothil with her hand plucking an arrow from her quiver.
"Put the bow down! Put the swords down! Put the crossbow down!" barked a voice from somewhere within the grass.
There was an uncertain pause, and then a bolt spat out of a nearby thicket, plowing the earth at Tothil's feet. Even as they watched, men began emerging in a crescent formation in front of them, swathed in cloaks of woven grass and reeds, but all with crossbows leveled. For a moment, Selma thought it was the wasps that had them. But they were ants, Tarkesh ants, with their pale faces smeared with dirt and green dye. Beneath the cloaks they wore armor of boiled leather and darkened metal.
"Weapons down!" shouted their leader, "or I shoot the lad with the crossbow. This is your last chance."
Tothil dropped the bow quickly enough, and his sword as well. Selma did the same, trying to gauge his chances of taking to the air. He counted 10 ants in all, and they would be in each other's minds. The least wrong move, and they all would see it. Selma did not rate his chances of dodging so many bolts. Skrill gave a hiss of annoyance and placed her bow on the ground, replacing the arrow in her quiver.
"What in blazes have we here?"
the ant officer asked, aloud for their benefit.
"A bag of half-breeds, it would seem."
Selma could only guess at the silent thoughts going meanwhile between him and his men.
"We're not with that army out there," he said hastily. "In fact, we're from Collegium. I can't see a crew like yours fitting in anywhere outside a freak show,"
the ant officer replied levelly.
"But what you are right now, lad, is prisoners. You'll come along with me, and anyone who does any tricks gets a bolt up the arse, and no mistake. There are folk in the city just waiting to speak to folk like you."
"We're not your enemies," Selma tried again. He tried a smile, but the officer was having none of it.
"You might be all sorts, lad, but I think you're spies looking to get inside the city. Looks like you got your wish too, doesn't it? Although not in the way you might prefer."
3. The Prowess Forum had never seen the like. This was no formal event, no meeting of teams from the Dueling League, and yet the backsides of the onlookers were packed all the way up the stone steps that rose in tiers at every wall. The aficionados of the duel were crammed in shoulder to shoulder, from college masters through the ranks of students and professional bladesmen to the children who followed their favorites with the fanatical loyalty of ants to their city. The fighters stood ready in the circle, which had been scuffed by 10,000 feet in the past. Neither participant was new to it. They had faced each other before, and there was nothing the crowd liked better than a rematch of champions. The master of ceremonies, the old Antkindan Kaiman of Kess, had tried to start the duel 3 times, but the crowd was refusing to quieten down for him. To one side stood the acknowledged champion of the Prowess Forum. He was Mattis Kindan, as the very best of the best always were. They were born with blade skill in their blood. It was the ancestor art of their nation. They came to the college sporadically, 1 or 2 in every year. When they fought, they inevitably claimed the prize, and then mostly they left. Pyreus of Netheon had stayed on, however, preferring the life of a champion of Collegium to anything his homeland might offer. He made his living in private duel, and by hiring out his skills to any dueling house so desperate for victory as to show the bad form of buying in a champion. Nor had he been short of offers this last year, for winning had ousted taking part as the fashionable thing. Now many magnates of Collegium kept dueling teams to further their prestige. But the crowd was here to see more than a haughty Mattis Kindan win yet another bout. Enough of them had gathered there to see his opponent. The less charitable said that they wanted to see her before some stroke dealt by Pyreus ruined her, for he was a misogynist at the best of times, and this match. The Mantiskindan saved their utmost barbs of loathing for one target. Why they hated the Spider-Kindan quite so much was lost in time, but they did. And they never forgot a grievance. Like most Spider-Kindan, she was beautiful. She was also unusual, in that she was a daughter of Collegium, not some arrogant foreigner. The name on the lips of the crowd as she entered was Tanisa. Properly, she was Tanisa Maker, but she was so obviously none of the old man's blood that just the one name sufficed. Piraeus was tall and lean, his face chiseled with distaste. The bruises he had given Tanisa when they had last met had healed, and it was obvious he was ready to gift her with another set. She was shorter than he, and slighter, an eye-catching young woman with her fair hair bound into a looped braid, and her green eyes dancing. There was something in the way she stood that told the best of them this was going to be a new kind of contest. She did not stand like a prowess duelist, or like a Spider-Kindan. In her time away from the city, she had learned something new. She had learned who she was, and what blood ran in her veins. But only Tanisa and two spectators there knew it. Kaiman called for silence once more, striking the two practice swords together in a dull clatter of bronze-covered wood.
"I shall not ask again!" he bellowed. "Silence now, or this match shall not take place!"
At long last the crowd quieted, under threat of its entertainment being removed. Kaiman nodded heavily and passed the swords out. They were in the hands of these fighters graceless things. Those two were meant for swords more slender and crafted of true steel.
"Salute the book!"
Kaiman directed, and they turned to the great icon carved at one wall of the forum and raised their blades.
"Clock!" barked the master of ceremonies and stepped back hurriedly.
Neither of them moved, even as the ponderous hands of the mechanical timepiece ground into motion. For a long moment, to the hushed anticipation of the crowd, they merely faced each other. Tanisa studied Piraeus's face, and knew that while she was seeing just what she had seen before, he could tell how she had changed. But he was proud, and he was a blur of motion as he now came for her, his ersatz blade swinging in tight arcs to trap her. She gave before him, barely parrying, making the fighting circle her world, backing around it so the darts and sweeps of his sword clove empty air. She thought he might get angry, since she had seen him provoked before. But he retained his icy calm, and his moves became tighter and tighter. And she was going to have to do something soon. In a sudden flurry, she had taken his sword aside, and in that instant she was on the offensive. She did not keep it long, but after that it was anybody's. She and Piraeus circled, stopped, circled back. The air between them rattled with the clash of their blades. The audience were on the edge of their seats, but the two combatants had forgotten them. Their world had contracted to that dueling ring. The prowess forum, with its clock and book, had ceased altogether to exist for them. He never gave up pressing his attack, for he knew the natural order of things was for him to advance, his foe to give way before him. He tried, and he tried, to turn the fight back to that familiar territory. He had done it before, when not so very long ago he had beaten her two strikes to none. Now she was holding him off, constantly turning his attacks into her own. Her guard was iron. He could not breach it, no more than she could break his. And the thought came to Tanisa. If these were live blades, I'd have killed him by now. His own Mattis blood was rising in her, and she saw Piraeus then as his own kind would. Look at this coward playing with children. He was all skill and poise, but the pride of his heritage had died within him. So let's call it real. and she gave her blood full rein. The orderly, calculated exchange of the prowess forum fell in pieces around them. She cut straight through, his blade passing inches from her face, and the point of hers rammed into his stomach. He doubled over, hit the ground shoulder first, and it took all of her will's work to hold back a second strike that would have broken his neck in lieu of opening his throat. She stepped back carefully with the slight sad thought that she could not return to this place. Her skills, once made here, had been reforged in blood in the outside world. The reflexes and instincts honed between life and death were not tame beasts for her to teach tricks to. Piraeus was slowly getting up, trying to catch his breath. She waited for him, motionless, and amongst the crowd not a word, not a fidget. He lunged at her, as swift a move as they had yet seen, and it would have caught her if she had been a mere duelist. She had moved before her eyes had registered his strike, the point of his sword missing by inches. She struck him a numbing rap to the elbow that sent the blade tumbling from his hand. After she had left, with the crowd baying her name, standing on the seats and cheering, few had eyes to watch Piraeus stand up again. His face was thunderous as he rubbed his injured arm. He made to leave by another door, but a voice stopped him. The doors to the prowess forum were left open always, and there was another Mattis Kindon lounging there. A man older than he, in an arming jacket of green. "An interesting fight." Piraeus narrowed his eyes. "The fight isn't over." "Yes, it is." The older man pushed himself off the wall, and Piraeus noticed that he had a claw over his right hand, a glove of metal and leather, with a blade that jutted a foot and a half from the fingers. It was the weapon of choice for mantids from the old days, and Piraeus recognized the stranger's sword and circle brooch a moment later. "A weapons master," he stated. And it was obvious he had never met one before.